Madison. Those two men made America. I learned of Jemmy's recent passing with a bolt of unexpected grief. Now, remembering how warmly he and Dolly received me at the White House, I feel the keenest sympathy for her loss. I wonder if I shall ever see her again to convey such sentiments in person. I'd like to. But there's a more important reunion I must bring about. I must see my son. I must have William home again from the wilds of America, where he fled in the wake of my suspicions about his father. I've made peace with Alexander. More importantly, I've made peace with myself. And I believe that all my husband's sacrifices and contributions, all our sacrifices and contributions, outweigh our personal private failings. I need William to see that too. Thus, at the first signs of spring, Lisbeth, her husband, and I set off on a 4-day stagecoach trip from New York to Pittsburgh, then down the wide Ohio. Weeks we steam along that waterway, and it seems only right that, despite how far William wandered, I am still able to reach him by river as if, all this time, we've been connected by the thread of life stitching through this great land. The farther west we go, towns give way to villages, which give way to mere wharfs. And I'm struck by the spirit of the American people, by the bravery and ingenuity of those intrepid enough to build new homes and communities. I can't help but wonder what my husband, who once crossed an ocean to find a new land of opportunity, would think of these new lands. He will never know this America, but I am grateful that I can. Though my gratitude is bittersweet, because these lands and others like them all over our country's western frontier are not settled without a price, and that great cost is borne by the Indians. With the support of Southerners who want ever more land for cotton and slavery, our government keeps pushing the Indians farther west. Proof that the great project of securing human rights through our revolution remains unfinished. Upon the steamboat, the great wheel creates a constant hum and vibration to which my body becomes accustomed as the weeks pass. We steam through Cincinnati and Louisville before finally reaching the Mississippi in late May. From there, we steam northward until we pass the quite considerable city at St. Louis, which boasts of over 10,000 inhabitants. Finally, the Mississippi carries us to Galena, Illinois, the largest steamboat hub in the north. And William is there waiting. I barely recognize him, not simply because 20 years have passed since I've seen him last, but also because he's embraced the look of a frontiersman. He wears the coarsest of trousers and a plain, threadbare shirt, clean but well used. Upon his head sits a slouched hat. Only his boots and his shave appear new, the latter of which is confirmed when a few of his fellows tease him about the disappearance of his beard. "Hello, Mother," he says stiffly, helping me down off of the gangway. "Oh, my dear William, you look..." I shake my head, overcome at the sight of him. Despite the rough edges, he's the spitting image of his father, and every bit as handsome. But I don't say any of that. "Well, it just does my heart so good to see you." We embrace, but it ends too soon, and then he greets the hollies, offers me his arm, and guides us to a wagon hitched with 2 black horses. It's an hour's ride to William's home in the neighboring Wisconsin Territory. "I should like for my town to someday be known as Wiota," he says, casting me an appraising look. "But most insist on calling it Hamilton's Diggings." I smile with delight. "Hamilton's Diggings? How grand. Perhaps I can now claim to have a town, too." He peers at me quizzically, and I remind him of a story he no doubt heard and forgot long ago. When you were small, your cousin Flip named a town upon the Genesee River for your Aunt Angelica. I've traveled 1,000 miles to see my son, but in so easily mentioning my sister's name, I realize how far I've truly come. Lisbeth excitedly calls out, "Oh, how exciting! Do we have a river, too, then?" Something close to a grin stirs upon William's face as he glances back at his sister.
"We do. The Pecatonica."
I try these Indian words out on my tongue, liking the feel of their newness there. And in William I can't help but see another similarity with his father. He's yet another Hamilton creating a new country. But I don't tell him that either. "How extraordinary," I say instead, surveying the lush greenery covering the mostly flat lands, where blue-purple flowers dot the wild grasses as far as the eye can see.
"I wouldn't have encouraged you to come here, Mother," he says, adjusting his hold on the reins. "This isn't New York. Everything is raw. Though my mine has been in operation for nearly 10 years, I only surveyed the town last year, and it is just 8 buildings. We're at the frontier."
"Fortunately, I remember what it's like to live on the frontier," I say, tightly gripping the rail along the bench seat's edge. For the transporting of lead from the mines has rendered the roads nearly impassable. I fear the wheels will not withstand the harsh impacts. But William navigates the hazards with competence and obvious experience. Then he waves a hand at the land ahead of us.
"My partners and I claimed over 1,000 acres out here. My furnace was the first in the eastern part of the county. Now miners come in droves to try to make their fortunes."
A few buildings come into view, rough-hewn and strewn along a river, strong enough to operate a grist mill and a sawmill. The village possesses a grocery and a general store, and we pass a small schoolhouse just beyond. In the distance appears the remains of an old fort surrounded by pickets and ditch. William tells me it's called Fort Hamilton, and that gives me pleasure.
"Welcome to Hamilton's diggings," he says, calling the team to a halt in front of 2 sturdy log cabins, and watching me for a reaction.
I make sure not to give him one, even as I wonder how he can possibly live in this place. For his cabin has no glass upon the window openings, and the door stands partly ajar. He jumps down from the wagon, then comes round to assist me. Entering the little hovel, I find naught but a rude bedstead with some dingy quilts and buffalo robes, an oaken table, a pair of wooden stools, and a few shelves of books. All is as tidy as can be, with the wind blowing through the windows and door, which has only a string latch upon it. I step closer to the books, smiling to find the works of Voltaire in French. At 40, William has never married. This cabin makes it clear that he has no intention of doing so. And I worry that he's going to spend the rest of his life alone. "Come home with me," I want to say. "We'll make things right." But when I turn, I find my son observing us taking in his space, and I can't say a word. His smile is slow in coming, as if he thinks I won't approve of his living conditions, and perhaps I don't. But finally his grin is there, illuminated by blue eyes so like Alexander's. But otherwise, he's different from Alexander in every way, as if by design. And that brings me to why I've come. I give Lisbeth a look that fortunately she understands. "Let's go explore the fort," she says to her husband. And when they depart, I turn to my son. "I wish to say something, William, and I need you to hear me." There's a hesitancy in his gaze when he nods, as if he's been anticipating this. "I know what you suspect about your father disappoints you, but he wasn't a perfect man. Mother, please," I say, needing him to hear me. "The truth is, William,
No union is perfect. We stumble, we fall, we hurt the ones we love. I think back on Lafayette's wisdom and draw strength from it. But the measure of a man, of a life, of a union of man and wife, or even country, is not in the falling. It's in the rising back up again to repair what's broken, to put right what's wrong. Your father and I did that. We always did that. He never stopped trying until the day he died, and neither will I.
William's gaze is uncertain, and then he blinks and looks away.
Swallowing hard, he says, I'm glad you were able to find your peace with him. When he looks back at me, his blue eyes are blazing with that achingly familiar illusion of violet. But I've been shaken in my conviction of who I thought he was, or hoped he was. And there's no way to repair that for me. No way to make it right between a father and a son. Not with him gone.
The pain in his expression threatens to break my heart, because I've felt that pain. I've worked the same equation. I've tried the same case. But unlike my son, I've been able to reach a conclusion, and I share this with him now.
Oh, William, I say, taking his hand. No man should be judged only for his best act or his worst, by only his greatness or his flaws. And no woman either, I think. For if my sister did betray me, did it obliterate all the ways in which she'd been my first and most constant friend? No, it did not. And I swallow as the thought heals another broken piece inside me. It seems, to me, I continue, that the only just way to judge a person is by the sum of their deeds, good and bad. And in the balance, your father did far more good than harm. That's all any of us can aim to do with our lives. William's throat bobs.
I was so small when he died that I can't remember him well. And yet I miss him,
he says, as if both admissions pain him. Reaching up, I take his face into my trembling hand. The same hand upon which I wear a gold wedding ring inscribed with my name and Alexander's. A ring that I will never again remove.
I miss him too. You must know, William. He loved you, and love is a kind of faith, a blessing to everyone it touches. Your father earned my love 1,000 times over, and I earned his in return. So I ask you to find peace with your father.
William looks at me for a long moment, and finally his expression goes soft.
My love for you allows me to do no other than accede to your wishes, Mother.
Then come home with me, I think. But I decide to savor this victory and put that battle off for later. When I know him a little better. Because the years have made him a stranger, I devote every moment of the time I have in getting to know my son. He brims with passion as he shows me his smelting furnace and explains the process of removing impurities from the crude lead dug from the ground. As he discusses his work, I hear the echo of Alexander's zeal in discussing policy and politics. And like his father, William has found success. Everywhere we go, the people all know William. Wisconsin's Hamilton, they call him, and respect what he's built and the man he's become. And despite my reason for coming here, I do too.
When William mentions a place he describes as the great natural wonder of the North, the Falls of St. Anthony, I naturally insist on seeing it.
Getting to the falls requires a steamboat ride and an 8-mile climb on horseback over winding trails. And I feel like the girl I once was, exploring the beauty of nature. I hear the falls before I see them. God in heaven, the sight is majestic. Multiple falls curve and twist,
the surging streams descending from 40 or 50 feet onto water and rock below. Spray rises up in great clouds that tickle my face in the breeze, filling me with a newfound vigor. William calls over the roar of the water, "The Dakota call the Mississippi Hahawakpa, or River of the Falls. They believe spirits live beneath them." I can understand the belief, for seeing such miraculous evidence of God's power imbues me with the feeling of being in the presence of something sacred. I am still moved when, later that afternoon, we return to Fort Snelling to find Colonel Campbell and his officers waiting at the entrance in full dress uniforms, for me, as if I was now the guest of the nation. The colonel offers me his arm and conducts me inside the four-sided fort, where a very fine band plays and an armchair waits upon a carpet. He bids me sit, and then, when the music stops, he speaks to his assembled troops. "We have with us today Mrs. General Hamilton, wife of the hero of Yorktown." A cheer rises up from the soldiers, and then, with weapons upon their shoulders, the troops march in formation, demonstrating a series of maneuvers. The display goes on for some time, and when it ends, I rise shakily to my feet, too moved to speak. For most of these men hadn't even been born while Alexander Hamilton still lived, yet have honored me this way. And in front of Alexander's son, who most needed to see it. When September brings cooler air and fields covered in lavender aster, my visit with dear William is near its end. Winter will soon choke the rivers with ice, making travel impossible. I have to go home. I've intended all along to ask William to come, but now I realize that I can't. I can't ask him to come home with me because William is home. I see that now. It would be wrong to deny him his place here, where new possibility hangs in the air. And yet, the realization is bittersweet, because I know I shall never return. I shall never see him again. And I think he knows it too. "Mother," he says gravely, planting a kiss atop my head, "I shall always be at your side, even as I make my own path here." His voice is tight with emotion, and all I can do is clutch at his strong, calloused hands. He's happy here. And how can I want anything more for my children than to have the liberty to pursue their happiness? It's what their father lived and died for, and it is enough. This aged petitioner, now numbering nearly 80 years, the widow of Alexander Hamilton and the daughter of Philip Schuyler, still cherishing an ardent attachment for the husband of her youth, wishes, before she too passes away, to see his publications spread before the American people. Hamilton must be classed among the men who have best known the vital principles and the fundamental conditions of a government. There is not in the Constitution of the United States an element to which Hamilton has not powerfully contributed. Congressional Report of the Committee of the Library on Elizabeth Hamilton's Petition. Washington City, July 4th, 1848. "Do you think they've patched up their quarrel?" I ask Mrs. Madison, who sits beside me in a carriage as it slowly rolls through streets lined with thousands of onlookers waving American flags. We're riding together to the ceremony celebrating both the 4th of July and the laying of the cornerstone to the new monument to the memory of George Washington. We're accorded positions of prominence in the celebration because we're the only remaining icons of the founding age, the only dignitaries left who personally knew the father of his country. Dolly and I are both turned out as elegantly as two aged widows can be. Me in my fanciest bonnet, the former first lady in a silk taffeta gown, black like my own. I live in Washington City now. So does Dolly. and she's still keen for gossip, leaning close enough that the white feather in her turban tickles my cheek. Has who patched up which quarrel? Why, our husbands in heaven, of course, I reply. She laughs and grasps my hand. Oh, my friend, I'm sure they have. Dolly pauses a moment before adding, Mr. Madison never forgot that the Constitution owed much of its existence to yours, and he once confided in me that no one but Hamilton could match him, nor force him to work so hard to make an argument. It's my belief that our husbands had no peers, even amongst the other great men of their time. The truth of the sentiment lodges a knot of emotion in my throat. Indeed, it is their friendship that has brought us and our country to this day. For though the idea to build a monument to Washington was as old as the nation, and attempts to raise sufficient funds for the cause were nearly 2 decades old, it was not until the society behind the monument's erection invited us to take up the mantle of memory that those efforts finally bore fruit. Working alongside Dolly, I organized dinners, teas, fairs, and every manner of entertainment. Adopting the same martial spirit that I'd once used to raise funds for widows, I'd cajoled contributions from passers-by and merchants on my daily 2-mile walk about the city. And at my annual New Year's Day open house, now one of the most anticipated and attended gaieties of the holiday season in Washington, I even required a donation to drink wine from the silver cooler General Washington gifted to us, raising a not insignificant sum for the honor. I've used my newfound celebrity as a relic of the Revolution to achieve a different end, too. Over teas with Washington's ladies, and in salons in my parlor, and even at a dinner with President and Mrs. Polk at the White House, I won support for a petition I submitted to Congress requesting that its library purchase my husband's papers and take over the task of preserving his legacy. I won from them, too, the long overdue acknowledgement that my husband was amongst this nation's fathers. I hope this victory means Alexander will be remembered when I am gone. And so it is that we, all of us, have arrived at this great moment. Cannon fire echoes against the bright blue sky, part of a series of salutes that has been ringing out all morning, and church bells chime from every quarter of the city. Amidst what appear to be tens of thousands of spectators, carriages deliver to the designated site representatives of America, from the president and cabinet to military units decorated in their proud bright uniforms, to fire companies and civic organizations with their colorful banners, to delegations of Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, and other tribes, wearing silver medals depicting Washington. So as to command a view of all the public buildings, the monument is to be built upon a hill overlooking both the Potomac River and the White House. But all I can see, all I can hear, is the great crowd of my fellow countrymen, singing, clapping, and chanting Washington's name as our carriage comes to a halt. Dolly is assisted down first by some notable, and then an exceedingly tall gentleman in a top hat comes forth to escort me toward the striped awning where we are meant to sit. He holds out his hand, and I grasp it, peering into dark, intelligent eyes. "Thank you, Congressman Lincoln," I say.
"It is my honor, Mrs. General Hamilton," he replies.
We make a comical sight walking together, as I've become so bent in my old age that he's forced to stoop to speak to me.
"I wished to mention, madam, that in recently rereading The Federalist, I am struck again, as one cannot help but be, by your late husband's devotion to the national good, though I fear that he possessed a prescience which too few of our contemporaries share."
"Oh?" I ask, wishing to make him elaborate. And he does, intoning Alexander's words.
"If these states should either be wholly disunited or only united in partial confederacies, the subdivisions into which they might be thrown
would have frequent and violent contest with each other, I finish, for I know the words by heart. Federalist number 6. A smile brightens Lincoln's rugged countenance.
Indeed, and every man who loves liberty ought to cherish in his heart a due attachment to the Union of America.
That was Mr. Madison, I say, unable to suppress a smirk. Federalist number 41. But I'll give you another chance. What do you say of Federalist number 9?
Are you testing me, Mrs. Hamilton?
He asks with a twinkle in his eye. I am, I admit.
A firm union will be of the utmost importance to the peace and liberty of the states, he quotes, then leans in closer. Have I passed?
I cannot help but laugh. You have, Congressman. He helps me toward my seat, located in the shade near the podium. As I sit, he bows, then turns to take his leave. Mr. Lincoln,
he raises a craggy eyebrow.
Yes, madam.
Because I know Lincoln to believe that the institution of slavery is founded on both injustice and bad policy, I'm emboldened to say, the true test is making certain that those who died in this country's service have not died in vain, in furthering the unfinished work our founders so nobly advanced.
He bows again.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Finally, the assembly settles and the crowd hushes for the oration commemorating George Washington. Eyeing the block of marble that will one day form the base of a giant obelisk monument, and grasping the pendant of his hair I still wear around my neck, I remember all we owe this great man. But Washington isn't the only patriot to whom a debt is owed. And some of them may never have a grand marble monument, no matter how much they deserve one. I'll make my peace with that, knowing that Alexander's accomplishments are inextricably entwined with Washington's. A monument to George Washington, I tell myself, is a monument to Alexander, too. And even to my father, in a way. Both of them, I know, would be glad of this day. Perhaps the speaker knows it, too, because he asks,
which of us does not realize that unseen witnesses are around us? Think ye that the patriot soldiers or statesmen who stood around Washington in war and peace are absent from a scene like this? Adams and Jefferson, by whose lives and deaths this day has been doubly hallowed. Hamilton and Madison are present, visibly present, in the venerated persons of those nearest and dearest to them in life, he says, pausing to turn and point at Dolly and me, bidding us to stand.
We do, hands clasped, and the crowd's applause vibrates under my feet. I lift my eyes heavenward into the bright July sky, wondering if the orator speaks truly. Are you here, Alexander? As if in answer at that very moment, the speaker recites a portion of the farewell address, calling out over the crowd,
properly estimate the immense value of your national union to your happiness and to your political safety and prosperity, watching for its preservation with jealous anxiety, discountenancing any who suggest it can be abandoned, and indignantly frowning upon every attempt to alienate any portion of the country from the rest.
Washington's words, but Alexander's too, even a few of mine. From the corner of my eye, I see Congressman Lincoln lean forward, listening intently, and warmth steals over me to realize that even beyond the grave, Alexander Hamilton still speaks to his country and his countrymen. That he'll continue to speak to generation after generation of Americans. That he's speaking to me, even now, as the sunlight plays warm over my cheeks. And I nearly laugh for the unexpected joy of our reunion. For nearly 50 years I've searched for my husband.
at the pastures, on the river, at his gravesite, and in the empty rooms of the house we built together, in portraits and busts and the faces of his children, in letters, pamphlets, account books, newspaper clippings, and treatises. I've searched for Alexander, despairing that there was no part of him still in this world, and that I couldn't be where any part of him is now. But Alexander is here, as warm and alive as the day we renewed our marriage and made love in the sun. He's inside me and all around me in the country that was created in his image. For there's not one person in the crowd who would be here without him. This city, this government, this nation would not exist without his efforts. Washington might be first in the hearts of his countrymen, but this is Alexander Hamilton's country. A stone monument can crumble. All eventually do. But Alexander built a monument for himself of ideas and ideals, weaving himself into the fabric of the nation such that not a thread can be pulled without destroying the whole. Oh, there are those who tried, and I supposed they might keep on trying. But as the speaker says, we've put the great American-built locomotive Liberty on its course, and now people the world over examine the model of this mighty engine and copy its construction and imitate its machinery. Alexander is everywhere people are heard calling their rulers to account. Alexander is everywhere the cry is raised for the right to vote, trial by jury, freedom of the press, written constitutions, representative systems, and republican forms. Which means I've been looking for my husband all along in the wrong place. Alexander once wrote, "The sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written as with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature by the hand of the divinity itself, and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power." And neither can Alexander Hamilton be. So, as the Marine Corps Band plays the Star-Spangled Banner, accompanied by the voices of 20,000 of my countrymen, I raise up my voice too. For my perilous fight is nearly over. I believe that all we worked for and built, the benign influence of good laws under a free government, will continue on as our happy reward forever, never perishing from this earth, even as I marvel that our starry banner of red, white, and blue still waves. Note from the authors. Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton's extraordinary life spanned nearly a century. She strived, struggled, and survived the first turbulent years of our nation's founding as the wronged wife at the center of America's first sex scandal. But she was much more than that. Coming of age in the relative frontier of upstate New York, Eliza, who apparently went by the name Betsy, at least in her early years, was the daughter of one of early America's most prominent men and ablest generals. As such, she had a front-row seat to the American Revolution. Descended from a line of physically strong and relatively independent New Netherlander matriarchs, Eliza was as well-equipped to entertain famous statesmen at her father's table as she was to traverse the wilderness to attend Indian conventions at her father's side. Eliza saw the chaos of war, the destruction of her family's country home, her father's loss of command, and the growing pains of a new nation. She also became the wife of Alexander Hamilton, one of America's most brilliant soldiers and political minds. Whether as a participant in Hamilton's astonishing career, helping him with his writings and publications, or as a victim of his ambitions and as an activist in her own right, she demonstrated an admirable strength of character that made her a wonderful heroine for a novel. And yet, very little primary source material exists about her, much less in her own hand. Most of what is gleaned about her is extrapolated from what we know about the men in her life.
The internal struggles she must have faced in the aftermath of betrayal and tragedy remain frustratingly out of reach for historians who, without all the pieces to put together a portrait of her emotional life, have not tried to paint much of a portrait at all, especially for the 50 years of her life after Alexander died. In fact, at the time of this writing, we are unaware of a single biography written about Eliza Hamilton. Even Ron Chernow's definitive biography of Alexander pays Eliza relatively little attention and does not always delve enough into her life to offer, in our view, the most considered interpretations of her character, motivations, and contributions. But, thankfully, fiction can go where historians rightly fear to tread. And as novelists, we were honored to look at the historical pieces of the puzzle and imagine the rich inner life that the historical fragments leave unspoken. We attempted to craft plausible answers to questions about Eliza's reaction to her husband's adultery, how she balanced her deep religious faith with disillusionment and worldly practicality, and how she might have come to terms with both the man and the country that she sacrificed for and which sometimes disappointed her. We're now happy to explain our approach, as well as the choices we made and the creative liberties we took. As with most works of historical fiction, the most outlandish bits are the true ones. The court-martials, battles, duels, and mutinies all happened. The scandals, riots, plagues, and mental illnesses, too. During her extraordinary life, Eliza Hamilton was a belle of both revolutionary balls and military camps. She did know the doomed British spymaster John André, and Hamilton's letters indicate that Eliza may have argued on his behalf. Washington is thought by some scholars to have been unusually tolerant, by the standards of the day, regarding the sexuality of his soldiers. And the Baron von Steuben was almost certainly homosexual. Eliza's uncle really was Washington's physician and a pioneer in the eradication of smallpox. Her mother and her aunt were known for helping at a makeshift hospital. According to the New York State Museum, Mama Schuyler did have an extraordinarily close relationship with her husband's commanding officer that might have troubled a husband less secure in the sanctity of his marriage. Meanwhile, a less secure Eliza Hamilton may well have put together the fact that Alexander Hamilton's entanglement with James Reynolds began long before he took Mrs. Reynolds to bed. Eliza did indeed assist her husband in his political endeavors. Some of his writings, including his economic treatise to Robert Morris, are in her handwriting. The historical Eliza helped to establish two orphanages, was a tireless activist in the name of charity, and made an arduous trip to the wilds of Wisconsin while in her 80s. The Hamiltons did shelter Lafayette's son, as well as the orphaned Fanny Antill. Though we had to guess at the real reason behind Fanny's departure from the Hamiltons' home around the time of the Reynolds scandal, as well as whether Fanny's later charitable work would have brought her back into Eliza's life. We certainly hope it did. Much of Alexander's dialogue comes from his letters, though we often had to shorten and modernize his famously long and complicated style for readability. And though most of Eliza's letters don't survive, we used them where we could. And the dialogue in her confrontation with Monroe comes from a family description of the event. But in the interest of conciseness, we have omitted, condensed, glossed over, or hand-waved 1,000 other historical details. Alexander lived only half as long as other founding fathers, and yet he managed to experience seemingly 10 times as much. We could not enumerate his many accomplishments within the confines of this novel, and because this was Eliza's story, not his, we did not attempt to. Instead, we've conflated or simplified events for maximum dramatic punch, and the astute reader might notice subtle changes in the timeline. Where a shift in the chronology didn't fundamentally change the choices faced by the people involved, we erred on the side of brevity. For example, Catherine Van Rensselaer Schuyler and her daughter Margarita Peggy Schuyler Van Rensselaer did both die in the month of March, but 2 years apart. This was a dark period in Eliza's life that included the deaths of Peggy, 1801, Philip, 1801, Mama, 1803, Alexander, 1804, and Papa, 1804. In consideration of Eliza and Alexander's arc during this troubled time, we moved Mama's death in order to highlight the couple's historical struggle to emerge from their grief in the period before Alexander's death. To give the reader a front row seat, we've sparingly placed our protagonist and other characters where they might not have been. One example is the Loyalist attack on Schuyler Mansion, and the chop of the wooden banister, for which there is a vivid and detailed account by a family member, but the veracity of its particulars is questionable. Another example is Evacuation Day, where the Hamiltons' arrival in New York was close enough that we wished to portray it. No one seems to know why Hamilton was not present at Washington's subsequent farewell in Frances' Tavern, so we had to come up with a reason. Our focus, as biographical historical novelists, of course, is on character. And that is where we were forced to do the most speculation. For example, historical paintings give proof that Eliza Hamilton was a petite and attractive woman. In fact, Talleyrand thought Eliza's beauty was underappreciated. Eliza's admirer, Tench Tillman, not only praised her as the finest-tempered girl in the world, but also portrayed her athleticism in his diary. Even well into her old age, we are told, Eliza insisted on taking very long walks, traversing fields and climbing over fences. As for her personality, her contemporaries describe her as impulsive and vivacious. She herself copied out a prayer to envision herself as an instrument of God's will. And within the realm of what was appropriate for women at the time, she was a relentless crusader, having, as one friend claimed, a rare sense of justice. These were all important details that we took into account in crafting Eliza's persona. But our approach to biographical historical fiction has always been to find the character-defining moment in a person's life and build a story around it. For Hamilton-centric historians, the defining moment of Eliza's life seems to be that she stood by her man and forgave her husband's infidelity. For us, her character-defining moment was the dramatic, documented encounter she had with an aging James Monroe. Just as in the novel, in the twilight of his life, the real President James Monroe wished to reconcile. But an uncompromising and stalwart Eliza wouldn't have it. What she wanted was an apology, which Monroe would not give. Again, what strikes Hamilton-centric historians about the much ballyhooed meeting was Eliza's loyalty to her husband. But what struck us about this visit was that Monroe made it at all. What would compel the so-called last founding father to seek out Eliza Hamilton? Though Monroe made it a principle of politics to engender his era of good feelings, by the time he paid call to Eliza, he'd retired from the presidency and politics. Nor does Monroe appear to have been motivated by guilt, because he didn't offer an apology when Eliza all but demanded one. So why go to the trouble? Especially since this inconvenient visitation almost assuredly took place at Eliza's home in New York, and not Washington, D.C., as is often posited. Eliza didn't move to Washington until the 1840s, at least a decade after Monroe's death. The answer doesn't seem to have been Monroe's nostalgia for his old friendship with Alexander Hamilton. In the sparse sketch of their encounter from Ellen McLean Hamilton, Monroe doesn't even mention his old friend and comrade-at-arms. Instead, the former president framed the speech he made to Eliza in terms of how long it had been since they met, and that their past differences could be forgiven and forgotten. This raised tantalizing questions. Just how long had it been since James Monroe met Eliza Hamilton? What was the nature of their meeting? What sort of relationship did they share that might motivate such an unprecedented visit?
and such a hostile reception. And what sort of power did she hold as a historical figure in her own right that he would prize a reconciliation with her? It's most probable that Eliza met James Monroe when he came to New York City to serve in Congress in 1785, possibly sooner. But we ruled out a family account published in a missionary pamphlet that places Eliza Schuyler at Valley Forge, because if she'd met Monroe there, she'd have met Hamilton as well. Yet, we noticed that after Monroe's heroics at Trenton, he became aide to Lord Stirling, who served in the Hudson Highlands during 1777. In that, we saw an opportunity. Because Lord Stirling tried to guide Lafayette successfully to Albany, where he conferred with Eliza's father, Philip Schuyler, we invented the notion that Lord Stirling sent Monroe to help, and that Monroe dined thereafter at Schuyler Mansion, where Eliza took a shine to him. Whether or not Eliza Hamilton would later have any cause to speak to Monroe, either on the night he came to Hamilton's house to investigate the Reynolds matter, or shortly before the publication of the Reynolds pamphlet, is not known. And as for any romantic feelings between them, we only know that Monroe was coy and secretive about his fondness for Dutch girls, one of whom turned him down when he asked for her hand after the war because she was already pledged. And of course, though Eliza assuredly was acquainted with Elizabeth Courtright before she married Monroe, the notion that Eliza introduced them is our fabrication. We have no historical evidence that Eliza was present with Lafayette at the Six Nations Convention at Johnstown, where the Oneida formally allied with the nascent United States. There is even some question as to whether or not Philip Schuyler personally attended that meeting. However, Eliza accompanied her father to at least one other Indian convention, and was adopted by the Iroquois, something important enough to her that she mentioned it to an interviewer near the end of her life. Moreover, an Iroquois assembly with Schuyler took place just prior to Lafayette's visit in the woods near Eliza's family home in November of 1777. So we rolled the experiences together so the reader might get a better view of the milieu in which Eliza became an adult, and so that we could demonstrate the revolution's impact on Native Americans. We thought it was important to do this because the American Revolution is too often seen as a struggle between white marbled men in powdered wigs spouting fine sentiments about liberty. The truth was more complicated, and the participants far more diverse. The Iroquois nations were drawn into both sides of the conflict. So were black people, both free and enslaved. And because Eliza's father was a plantation-owning slaveholder, she had opportunities to witness and ultimately empathize with their struggles. Our readers might recall that in America's First Daughter, the story of Martha Patsy Jefferson Randolph, we had the unique opportunity to portray the enslaved families at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, because quite a bit is known about the people who lived there. Unfortunately, not as much is known about the approximately 30 enslaved human beings on Philip Schuyler's property. Consequently, in this novel, we hesitated to put too many words into their mouths or feelings in their hearts, but tried to honor them by using some of their names and vocations. We also confronted the probability that Eliza's entanglement with slavery did not end when she left her father's household. That Alexander Hamilton opposed slavery is absolutely true. So did Jefferson, though to a less efficacious degree. That did not stop either man from compromising his moral beliefs in pursuit of personal or political goals. In short, despite his anti-slavery stance, there is historical evidence that Alexander Hamilton did borrow, hire out, and possibly even own enslaved persons. Which is why we decided to employ the character of Jenny to demonstrate the ambiguities surrounding this particular question, and Eliza's evolution in thinking on the matter. Unfortunately, because little survives in Eliza's own hand, It's difficult to discern what her relationships were with enslaved persons. We know from one letter that she was distressed by one of her servants dying of yellow fever, and that she eventually spoke with contempt about the institution of slavery itself and its corrupting influence on the body politic. Eliza Hamilton's friends, relations, and acquaintances are a veritable who's who of American history, including many fascinating figures we didn't have room to introduce, such as Ben Franklin, the Vicomte de Noailles, the Marquis de Chatailleux, Talleyrand, Martin Van Buren, James and Sarah Polk, and many more. She personally knew at least 12 of the first 16 presidents, and was present with Congressman Abraham Lincoln at the dedication of Washington's monument. The Revolution and the business of nation-building was, for Eliza Hamilton, a family affair. And Eliza was particularly close to her family. After the loss of Fort Ticonderoga, General Schuyler was certainly held in contempt, and, according to contemporary Dr. James Thasher, accused of collecting a bribe from the British in silver bullets shot over the fort's wall. Even Schuyler's future son-in-law, a young Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Hamilton, once suspected him of treachery. But Schuyler's reputation in Albany was more secure than we have portrayed it. So much so that New Yorkers were trying to send him to Congress before he'd even been vindicated at court-martial. Our choice to have Eliza overwrought about her father's reputation lent a nice echo for the constant worries she'd be faced with when it came to her husband's reputation later in the book. Eliza would not have believed her father guilty of the crimes for which he stood accused, nor would she have likely believed him guilty of wrongs he did commit. And so we have portrayed Schuyler here through the lens of a loving daughter's eyes. Note that while Peggy probably did not elope, the fact that three, if not four, of his intelligent and headstrong daughters chose to do so, without real fear of consequence, speaks to him as a more indulgent father than his historical reputation for sternness might otherwise indicate. Certainly, Eliza Hamilton honored and relied upon her father as a protector and benefactor, and his death likely forced her to contend with the world as a more independent woman than she would have liked to have been. Eliza's relationship with the daughters of Governor William Livingston is documented, though it is possible, and maybe even likely, that Kitty Livingston sided with her brother-in-law, John Jay, in political matters. We used her as a stand-in for the political rupture between the Schuyler and Livingston families. We were particularly interested in the relationship she formed with the Burrs and Madisons. The Hamiltons and the Burrs socialized frequently together, and so we've posited a friendship between Eliza and Theodosia. We moved some of the discrimination Theodosia experienced as the wife of a British officer during the war to after the war as a demonstration of public prejudices. And because Theodosia was forward-thinking in matters of philosophy and women's rights, we attributed other liberal ideas to her as well. The partnership between Alexander Hamilton and James Madison was amongst the most fruitful in the history of government. That these two brilliant and hard-working founders could work together in such close harmony, so urgently and with such success, only to become political enemies, is a great American tragedy. But we were delighted to find some grace notes there. The respect with which Madison treated Hamilton's family, the assistance he lent them in gathering Hamilton's papers, and the friendship that his wife Dolly shared with Eliza even after both of their husbands were in the grave. Long before Dolly Payne Todd married James Madison, she and Eliza Hamilton were neighbors in Philadelphia in the early 1790s, living only a block apart on Walnut Street. Eliza most likely made the acquaintance of Dolly at one of Martha Washington's receptions, at which Eliza was a fixture and Dolly was a frequent guest. The willingness of these ladies to put aside partisanship so that they could work together raising funds for the Washington Monument, and orphans,
suggested to us a long friendship, so we put one in the book. Another long and heartwarming real friendship existed between Eliza and Lafayette, with whom she exchanged letters long after Hamilton's death. Lafayette's triumphant visit to America in 1824 began in New York City on August 16th. He then returned to New York again in early September, and it was at this time he took Eliza Hamilton with him in his carriage to inspect West Point, expressing that Hamilton had been as a brother to him. It seems that she was amongst those who left the ball late and chugged off in a steamboat with him into the night. Lafayette returned again to New York at the end of September for another round of celebrations, but in our story, we conflated all three visits for brevity and simplification. And we thought it extremely likely that Eliza Hamilton was amongst the escort of ladies associated with the Free School that Lafayette toured because Lafayette's secretary mentions, in the same breath, intimate details about the founding of Eliza's orphan asylum. When he was in America, Lafayette spent much time laying cornerstones and visiting memorials of his fallen revolutionary comrades. And we know he visited St. Paul's, the chapel near Trinity, because his secretary made special note of the Trinity graveyard. It's difficult to conceive of Lafayette visiting that graveyard without stopping to pay his respects to Hamilton. So we included a graveside scene and combined it with Eliza's emotional epiphanies. Additionally, there is some historical confusion over the burial place of Philip Hamilton, but we chose to accept the interpretation presented in the Book of Trinity Church History that says he is buried in the same plot as his father and mother. It's also unclear why Angelica Schuyler Church is buried in the Livingston vault. Angelica fostered with the Livingstons as a girl, and there may have been a closer familial connection there. But the ambiguity fit well into the narrative, and so we used it to our purposes. Another friend of Eliza's was James McHenry, who did, indeed, get pulled back into the political fray during the Madison administration, in part because of John Adams maligning him in the press, but also because his advice was sought with regard to the forthcoming War of 1812. McHenry escorting Eliza to Washington City, though plausible, is our invention, so that he could serve as a stand-in for the Federalists she lobbied at this time. Then there is the matter of Eliza's enemies. Her first meeting with Thomas Jefferson probably took place in New York, when Jefferson arrived to take up the mantle of Secretary of State, not in Philadelphia as we portrayed it, before he served as ambassador to France. But because Jefferson happened to be in Philadelphia with his daughter when the Hamiltons were there, we found it hard to resist giving the reader a glimpse of young Patsy Jefferson of America's first daughter. As for Aaron Burr, it isn't known if Eliza played a part in his exile from New York. But there is circumstantial evidence that she was lobbying New York society, with her grieving children in tow, only days after Hamilton's death. Eliza is known to have come face-to-face with him only once after the duel. The occurrence took place on a ferry, and thereafter the rumor went round that Eliza had screamed upon seeing Burr's face, and that Burr coldly went about eating his supper. In fact, Eliza only stared icily at Burr and retained her composure, but she never corrected the record, presumably because the story made him look heartless and irredeemable. Saintly or not, Eliza Hamilton could hold a grudge. She could also hold her silence. For example, she left nothing behind to tell us how she felt upon learning of her husband's infidelity with Maria Reynolds. Historians have inferred, from the way her family wrote to her about the controversy surrounding the Reynolds pamphlet, by placing the blame upon envy and newspaper men, that Eliza tolerated her husband's adulteries, and that she was only distressed to see them exposed. But if that were the case, we think it unlikely Hamilton would have submitted to blackmail in the first place. We think it more probable that those family letters,
and Hamilton's own restrained mention of his wife's likely feelings on the matter, are simply evidence of the fact that Eliza had already learned about the affair and forgiven it years before. Whilst he lived, Hamilton certainly exerted a measure of charm that allowed many